The Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for March is a giant poster of Luther's Small Catechism. It's perfect for display in your home, Christian day school, or Sunday school. You can browse before you buy at issuesetc.org, or you can purchase the Small Catechism giant poster by calling Concordia Publishing House 1-800-325-3040. 1-800-325-3040. The Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for March, the Small Catechism giant poster. Science today is not known for its restraint, is it? We have that image of kind of the mad scientist who will risk life and limb and everything else in pursuit of new knowledge, new discovery, some sort of cutting edge thing. And look, there is a little truth, a kernel of truth in that. There's a lot of money on the line when it comes to medical research, finding cures, as we often hear kind of a generic term for, or justification for just about anything science wants to do, anything that researchers want to do, in particular when it comes to human beings. We have ethical concerns about all of it, as we should, but those ethical concerns are not often, at least apparently, shared by a lot of the research community, except you pick up the journal Nature and you find a group of researchers who are saying, let's think about this before we move ahead. Let's take a year, talk about it, and agree about how we're going to limit our research when it comes to what's called DNA editing, especially on human beings. Joining us to talk about this in just a minute here, Scott Stiegemeyer. A little bit later in this hour, Pastor Tom Baker joins us to teach a Sunday school lesson. We will be talking about the widow's mite in Mark chapter 12. I'm Todd Wilkin. Welcome back to Issues, Etc. Feel free to join us with questions or comments for the next hour, 1-877-623-6943, 877-623-MYIE. Send us an email, talkback@issuesetc.org. Send us a tweet at IssuesETC, and our beloved on-demand listeners, feel free anytime, any place to use the Issues, Etc. comment line, 618-223-8382, 618-223-8382. Joining us to talk about bioethical concerns about DNA editing, Scott Stiegemeyer. He's a pastor at Redeemer Lutheran Church in Elmhurst, Illinois. He has a master's degree in bioethics, and he co-hosts a podcast called The Crux of the Matter. Scott, welcome back to Issues, Etc.
Hey, Todd. It's good to be here.
How troubling do things have to be in scientific research, especially when it comes to finding cures, that even the scientists themselves say, let's talk about this before we move on?
Yeah, well, that's a pretty good observation, that if the scientific community is saying, let's put on the brakes, it must suggest that there's some serious danger. Now, to be fair, though, the scientific community, there are other examples of areas where they've urged restraint and seem to have been fairly successful, and that is in, for instance, germ warfare. The world community has basically said, we don't want to encourage this, and most industrialized nations have backed that. And by and large, we haven't had a serious problem with that as of yet. A couple of years ago, some scientists had published or made public on the internet the genome for the 1918 influenza virus, which was devastating to human life in 1918. And some scientists were very critical of those who had published that. So there are other examples of times when they say, hey, you know, we see the greater good here could be badly, badly harmed.
So what are we talking about, this DNA editing, as it's called in, as being called in the press?
Yeah, what they can do, what we're learning how to do, is to literally go in and edit the code, the genetic code for a human being. This raises questions. Science is raising fundamental questions about what is a human being. And what are the applications? You mentioned this in your intro. The positive applications would be that we, in theory, would be able to go in to an embryo or a zygote that we anticipate will have a genetic disorder, and we would be able to prevent that. And who would not, you know, anybody that has ever known someone with cystic fibrosis, for example, would say, hey, you know, I'm in favor of some kind of genetic editing that would in theory, cure a disease. The problem is there's a big difference between editing what they call somatic cells and germ cells. Germ cells are what you pass down, what gets inherited, and that's what the scientists were responding to today.
So they are essentially saying, they're not saying let's not go forward. What are they saying?
Yeah, you're right. No, that's exactly, they're saying let's, with somatic research, that's an important distinction, somatic cells, body cells, that are not involved in reproduction. They don't affect the sperm or the egg. So they're saying with a particular person or a patient, if we can go in when they're in utero, and or even later through medications and therapies, alter their genetic code so that they don't have the symptoms of a disease, then we would want to do that. But we don't want to do it to the types of cells that would affect their progeny, because we can't predict all the outcomes, all the possible ramifications of that.
And when we say can't predict, we don't know what we're doing, right? I mean, when it comes to – we've talked about mapping the human genome, but that's like saying I have a map of the United States and the only thing on the map is the general shape of the continent and the borderlines between the states. But that's about as detailed as our map really is, isn't it?
Well, that's exactly right. I mean, it's not as if genes only do one thing and we kind of identify, well, this gene does this thing and then we can change that. We don't necessarily know the way that all the different ways that the genes work together and the different combinations and the role of environment on various traits is still, you know, this is a very fuzzy area to be experimenting in and dangerous for a number of reasons.
Let's talk about the often invoked justification when it comes to things that are already being done, like destructive embryo research. They're not tinkering with genes as much as you are tinkering with, in a more gross way, with human beings already and destroying them in the process. The cures, the prospect of finding cures, how do we respond to that?
Well, as Christians, I think on the one hand, we want to say Jesus had a healing ministry. We certainly are in favor of healing, and the church has always been very involved in ministry to the sick in terms of founding hospitals and supporting research and so forth. So we're in favor of cure, but when we start to talk about traits that are not purely therapeutic traits, that are cosmetic or other types of traits, that's when I think we want to draw a really, really dark ethical line. It's one thing to talk about curing an illness. It's something else about talking about altering traits for other reasons.
Even if there is the prospect or promise of a cure at the end of a line of research,
sure.
Are there still ethical concerns that need to be observed? If so, what are they?
Yeah, I mean, we want to be the thing is, Todd, as we've kind of touched on, we simply don't know all the ways, all the outcomes. And one of the articles that I was looking at today said that, you know, the scientists were saying it's even impossible to predict what all the different outcomes might be if we start to alter the genome of a human being in terms of the hereditable traits. It's all fine and good to pursue a cure, and we want to do that. And so there's, you know, on the one hand, we don't want to say, we don't want to be alarmist. I don't think we want to overreact and say all genetic research is to be forbidden. There might be some kinds of therapies that can be done that are not going to undermine or rewrite the definition of a human being. If we can identify those, if the scientific community agrees that this is safe and will not affect future generations, then probably we would want to be able to support that. But if it's going to be something that's going to change the future of humanity at this most fundamental level, it's hubris to say go forth.
How would you assess the kind of current state of bioethics when it comes to these big questions, the kind of questions that even have scientists pausing for a moment?
Well, you know, I mean, that's a profound question. I would love to see a time when we would have our federal government support sort of a bioethical commission like we have had in the past and with other administrations. Some good stuff came out of the President's Bioethics Commission under George W. Bush. Leon Cass and some others were some very sane bioethicists and were producing some very – Arthur Kaplan and others were on that. And they weren't necessarily coming from a religious right perspective all the time, but they were coming from a sort of a traditional viewpoint and in terms of ethics and morality. And they urged caution, but they, you know, we don't want to say at the same time, let's throw science out. All science is bad and all research is bad. What concerns me with this particular thing is the money that can be made from cosmetic alterations. We know how much money people spend for cosmetic surgery and other types of cosmetic procedures. And one thing these articles, the articles that I've read today, no one has addressed is the possible militarization of this kind of technology. And I think that would be something we would want to be concerned, that the general populace would be concerned about.
What are you talking about there?
Well, if I can change your genes so that I can take away an illness, then in theory I can go in and give you blue eyes or green eyes or brown eyes, because that's a heritable, I mean, that's a trait that's determined by genes. So, you know, maybe the parents will say, we believe that blonde children are not taken seriously, that blonde people, you know, there's so many jokes about the dumb blonde that we don't want our children to be blonde. We want our children to have dark hair. Okay, well, it sounds innocuous, but if I can do that sort of thing, then, you know, for one thing, we're going to see a homogenization of humanity. We're going to see traits selected out. You know, what if people want to select out, remove some of their racial features, for instance, because they think it might give them an advantage in society and in the greater society? I think that's an area of concern. And the militarization angle is simply, why not give someone, make all of our, you know, offspring 6 feet 7 inches tall and give them a stronger musculature so that they can, in theory, be super soldiers? I don't want to sound too science fiction-y, but I don't think that that's outside the realm of possibility.
So you're not just talking about what dangers it may pose to our progeny. You're talking about dangers it may pose to society.
Yeah, and I think when we talk about bioethics concerns in the greater conversation, I mean, when we're talking with fellow Christians, we can share scripture and we can talk about it in a certain way, but I think we have to be able to frame these discussions so that the general population, which may not share our religious beliefs, will understand them. And I think we can point to some of these things and say, well, it's not just about, you know, we believe that God is our creator and we need to be receptive to his handiwork. It's also about, look, when we start tinkering with things like this, we could see social outcomes that will be, you know, monstrous, and not to even just limited to the possible mistakes that we would make inevitably, but to the, if there was an unscrupulous government who was pursuing this technology, why not have those features that you want to see in a super soldier be selected for? I could see that happening.
Scott Stiegemeyer is our guest. He's pastor of Redeemer Lutheran Church in Elmhurst, Illinois. He has a master's degree in bioethics, and he co-hosts a podcast called The Crux of the Matter. You found a link to this new podcast under the Listen On Demand page at issuesetc.org. When we come back, let's talk about what makes us different from other subjects of medical research. Because after all, the DNA editing has already been successful in animal models. Why not move to human beings? Aren't we just another subject of research? We'll be right back. Have you recently graduated from high school or college and are still making up your mind about your future career? Here's an opportunity to serve your neighbor through an extended, uniquely Lutheran service program. It's called the Lutheran Youth Corps. Find out more about the Lutheran Youth Corps at lcms.org/youthcorps. Life together through witness and mercy, the Lutheran Youth Corps. lcms.org/youthcorps.
We know that you want to build your family on the right foundation from the very start, the foundation of Jesus Christ. Concordia Publishing House offers more than 8,000 products for churches, schools, and homes, dedicated customer service, and an experienced staff to help you focus on what matters most. Click to connect at cph.org. Concordia Publishing House. Listening, responding, providing for God's people. Concordia Publishing House, cph.org.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Imagine steadfastlutherans.org as the internet version of your neighborhood pub. Your neighborhood confessional Lutheran pub, that is, where the finest in Lutheran conversation is going on at every table and at the bar, sometimes contentious, but always informative and unabashedly Lutheran. We're only serving Wittenberg Ale. We even have a guy named Norm. So check us out. www.steadfastlutherans.org. We'll save a seat at the bar for you.
Listen to the best of the church's music for the season of Lent at LutheranPublicRadio.org. Sacred music for the season of Lent, LutheranPublicRadio.org.
Welcome back to Issues, Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're talking about bioethical concerns surrounding DNA editing. Pastor Scott Stiegelmeyer is our guest. Now, I note from the coverage of this that this DNA editing has already had some salutary results in animal models, and I think it's always going in this direction of medical research. How does it benefit human beings? This isn't just about finding cures for rats or pigs or other animals that may be used in medical research. What's the line between the two? Why are animal models distinct from research with and upon human beings?
Well, if the question is about research ethics, the big difference is the ability of the subject to consent to the research. So that's one topic we want to make sure that we consider. And that's one of the concerns that is raised by the scientists with the article that we're discussing now. With gene editing on an embryo or a zygote or a subject in utero, they're obviously not able to give informed consent that you're doing a certain thing to them. And especially if we're talking about alterations that are not therapeutic in nature, that they're not attempting to cure a life-debilitating disease, but rather simply to just customize traits. So we want to, on the one hand, you know, we can raise that question, informed consent. But and animals are not required. We don't seek the consent of the animals that we experiment on. But the bigger question is, what is the nature of being a human being? Well, what sets us apart from the animal kingdom? If I'm a materialist, Todd, if I just believe that all that exists are atoms and energy, I'm a materialist, then it's real hard for me to make much of a case, except for maybe a pragmatic one, against this. Because, look, we're just advanced apes. We're just advanced animals from that perspective, from that Darwinist materialist viewpoint that doesn't believe that man has a spiritual nature. But we do. We coming from the Christian perspective, and even those coming from other religions would probably acknowledge that human beings are unique in all of creation because we have a spirit that is able to commune with God and in a way that the animals do not.
So are we talking here in classical theological categories when it comes to answering questions like this, moral and ethical questions like this? Are we talking about the image of God?
Yeah, that I think so. I mean, in terms of our theology, Lutherans tend to identify the image of God language as referring to the original righteousness of Adam and Eve in the garden before the fall that they possessed, but which they lost. So often in our in confessional Lutheranism, when we're talking about the image of God, we're referring to something that was lost, and that is that original righteousness. But we have to be aware that the Roman Catholic communities and the evangelical communities, when they use the image of God language, they acknowledge that original righteousness piece, but they are also referring to something inherent in human beings that makes us set apart from all of creation, whether that is our reason, whether that is our artistic ability, you know, sometimes it's variously identified. And one of our theologians, Dr. Jastrom, wrote an article in CTQ where he traces back the use of image of God in Martin Luther and Philip Melanchthon and some of the other early Lutheran reformers, and found that they were sometimes loose with their use of the term too. But usually in confessional circles, when we're talking about image of God, we're talking about that original righteousness, and maybe we leave it there, but we have to be aware of the other possible component when we're talking to people.
What are the pastoral concerns here? You've had this experience. I know you've been a pastor for some time. Where, and I'm sure it's come up, where at least in theory someone's entertaining the idea of doing something medically, and they're in a tough position to think it out theologically or rationally, because a loved one of theirs it wants cure. Or in the case of, say, in vitro fertilization, a young couple desperately wants to have children, and a good impulse on their part. How do you sort these things out when the ethical concerns begin to
rise? Those are good impulses, and we want to be sure that we acknowledge that it's a good impulse when a couple says we want to procreate. That's a God-given instinct or desire. There's a lot of pastoral application to studying bioethics, and this is just going to be my opportunity to give a little bit of a plug that I think that our clergy and our laity, but it would be nice if our clergy did a little more serious study in the bioethical sphere. There are going to be lots of opportunities, everything from the in vitro fertilization question to end-of-life questions, quality-of-life questions. These are going to become more and more prominent as time goes on, as the baby boomer generation ages. We're going to have more and more scenarios, and with the healthcare complexities that we have to battle and deal with, there's going to be more and more questions about what types of treatments are acceptable and what role does the patient's autonomy play. There's just so many philosophical and that verge on theology that we have to have a clergy and a pastorate that's able to discuss those things.
How, this is what I have found particularly useful for at least framing the issues in my mind when it comes to real life people who, out of good impulses to see another cured, to be cured themselves, to have children, all of those things, to see another, a loved one not extended in their suffering, in particular at the end of life, all of those things that you want to applaud as a pastor. But the framework that I have found particularly helpful, and I want your thoughts on it as well, is the theology of the cross, that life comes at every stage and every aspect of it with a number of crosses, and sometimes Christians do suffer, and sometimes it is our call to suffer. What do you think about that?
Well, that's where I think Lutherans really have something to bring to the table when it comes to the bioethical discussions that take place in society. We're not the only ones. I mean, you know, the evangelicals and the Catholics, they may not call it the theology of the cross, and they may not frame it exactly that way, but they do often. There is sort of a certain amount of literature about the virtue or the value of suffering, if you will. I don't want to say virtue of suffering, but there can be value in it. We tend to want to say that the ultimate value is to have a suffering-free life. And while I want to do everything that is reasonable and ethical to alleviate suffering of my neighbor, the Good Samaritan story tells us to do that. You know, we're to alleviate the suffering of our neighbor. But not to the point where we're crossing God's boundaries and transgressing his laws. And then in those cases, there are going to be times when we simply don't have an answer, and we simply cannot cure something without taking a human life or doing something unethical to achieve that. So we do have to be able to talk about the bearing of the cross and what it means to, how that draws us closer to the Savior, and how we identify with the Savior and are brought into solidarity with the Savior sometimes through our sufferings. This is an excellent point. And as pastors, that's going to be something that we have an opportunity to express to people. And it's always best to do this in advance. It's always hardest to do this when people are actually facing a decision or when they're actually undergoing some kind of horrible trauma. That, if you start to talk to them about theology of the cross at that time, you sound very removed. But if we do a good job of catechizing people and bringing the bioethical questions to the fore in our normal teaching and preaching, then you know people are going to be acquainted with this theology of the cross when they encounter opportunities to apply it.
That's a fantastic point. I mean, the task begins today before the Schmitz approach you and Grandma is at the end of life.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And I think you can do this a lot of different ways if you're a pastor. You can hold special classes that will be, you know, on end-of-life questions. I think just being upfront about it. But, Todd, I find all the time when I'm preaching, when I preach through the Gospels and I see the healing ministry of Jesus and the human care aspect of the ministry of the apostles, there's opportunities there, too. We're always talking about what I would call sort of a theology of the body, that we are embodied beings and our bodies are good, and there's lots of ways that you can go with that and lots of opportunities in a normal everyday ministry to make those applications, connect those dots.
When it comes to the forefront of science, and here we stand at yet another forefront, a threshold, DNA editing, someone might say, look, if you want to bring God into the conversation, I'll tell you what I think. If God didn't want us to do this, he wouldn't have given us the ability to do this. How do you assess that particular kind of bioethical reasoning, if you can call it that?
Yeah, you know, I mean, of course God does give us reason, and he gives us our senses, and he still upholds those things, and he wants us. I do. There's a grain of truth in that, isn't there? I mean, there's a grain of truth in saying God has given us the capacity to develop technology. What a marvelous thing. And we all benefit from technology. We're talking on the radio right now. People around the world are going to be able to hear these words because of technological research. And we are able to cure illnesses that would have been death sentences just a generation or two ago. Everything from organ transplants to blood transfusions, all of those things have been controversial in their infancy. So we want to acknowledge the goodness of the scientific endeavor, that it can be done in a godly way, and if you're a Christian and you are a scientist, that those things are not incompatible. They're very compatible. In fact, it's God's world that we inhabit. But he does want us to be humble, and God will humble us, I think, if we start to do things out of arrogance and we start to overstep and have an undue confidence in our abilities, then I think we're going to see tragedy.
Scott Stiegemeyer is pastor of Redeemer Lutheran Church in Elmhurst, Illinois. He has a master's degree in bioethics, and he co-hosts a new podcast called The Crux of the Matter. Scott, thank you very much for your time.
It's a pleasure.
It's Monday, March the 16th, and when we come back, since it is Monday, we usually talk with Pastor Tom Baker, teach a little Sunday school lesson, get ready for the Sunday school lesson coming up on the coming Sunday, and we will be doing just that. The Widow's Mite, a very short little story from Mark chapter 12 of Jesus making some observations around the offering plate, for lack of a better word. We'll be right back.
Organist Service, aptly abbreviated SOS, really has come to our rescue.
Pastor Jim Hollowatch of Christ Lutheran Church in Jackson, Mississippi.
With the ever-growing shortage of skilled musicians in our community, we were approaching a real crisis. But thanks to the Substitute Organist Service, help is always just minutes away. With its easy, intuitive interface, friendly customer service, and outstanding musicianship, you really couldn't ask for more.
You can find out more about the Substitute Organist Service at churchmusicsolutions.com.
This is Pastor Clint Poppe, Good Shepherd Lutheran Church in Lincoln, Nebraska, a proud supporter of Issues Etc. Each month we host the Nebraska Lutherans for Confessional Study, a serious study of Lutheran theology. We generally meet on the fourth Thursday of each month from 9:30 to 2:30, and both clergy and laity are invited. There is no charge to attend. For more information, please call the church office or visit our website, goodshepherdlincoln.org, and click on the green NLCS tab.
Did you know that Luther Academy has been providing continuing education for confessional Lutheran pastors and laypeople worldwide for more than 20 years? Luther Academy publishes Logia, the Confessional Lutheran Dogmatics series, and Luther Digest. Find out more about Luther Academy and sign up to receive their free email newsletter at lutheracademy.com. lutheracademy.com and like them on Facebook, facebook.com/lutheracademy.
Listen to chapel services live weekday mornings from Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana at issuesetc.org. Morning Chapel from Kramer Chapel, live weekday mornings, 9 Central, 10 Eastern, 8 Mountain, and 7 Pacific at issuesetc.org.
Your lifeline to the Lutheran worldview. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Hey, St. Louis. How would you like to achieve your fitness goals in a fun and supportive atmosphere? Hi, this is Kevin Reisick, owner and operator of Arch Fitness of East Alton, Illinois. We offer adult boot camps throughout the week. These camps include cardiovascular conditioning, muscular strength and endurance training, balance and coordination activities, and more. For more information, give me a call at 618-670-6952, Arch Fitness of East Alton, Illinois, 618-670-6952.
It's here, it's here, it's finally here. Lutheran Catechesis Catechist Edition. A comprehensive guide to catechesis for a Lutheran congregation, including expanded helps on the catechism, a section of catechesis on the table of duties, Christian vocation, and learn-by-heart schedules for the congregation at prayer. Order yours today from the Concordia Catechetical Academy at peacesussex.org.